Nashville, June 26. On the second Tuesday before the 4th, Berryman came out the electric doors of the farmer's market with a milk bottle quart of orange juice and a pound of farm wife powdered donuts. He was wearing khaki pants, a wrinkled Coca-Cola shirt with the sleeves rolled up over his biceps, and he was a dead ringer for a Tennessee redneck, in his body and in his mind. He sat down on the warm hood of his Hertz Ford Galaxy, fingered the milk bottle braille, and admired Nashville women doing their thing, shopping. He ate several of the warm donuts, which were nice, even sitting on hot metal. As usual, his independence delighted him. It was 11 a.m., and his job for the day was easy, with high pay. Traffic was light through the early afternoon. It was a day of one-bag pickups. There were occasional gypsy bands, excellent wives nonetheless, in curlers with their kerchiefs puffed high over their foreheads like bird cages. There were childlike old men in aloha sports shirts, with baggy trousers belted high around their waists like mailbags. Sometimes Berryman would strike up conversation with one or the other, but in the main, he kept his eye on two Amos and Andy Negro carpenters handcrafting a platform stage in the middle of the parking lot. Jimmy Horn would speak from the platform. Berryman sat on the Ford. Then he walked the perimeter of the airfield-sized market lot. He visited a few plaza shops, bought a J.C. Penney olive shirt and tie to clash with his Bond suit, watched a policeman reading a comic book in a patrol car. There was a 30-gauge shotgun propped up facing the windshield in the front seat. Around lunchtime, he sat under a Cinzano umbrella outside of Lum's, and he sipped Cinzano at the urging of a waitress named Dee Dusty. Afterward, she remembered him. Across a narrow arcade, the farmer's market roof was long, flat, pitched tar. It got hot and gooey by mid-afternoon. The tar oozed at the edges of the gutter. The building's front facade, a red-on-royal-blue sign, rose about 3 feet higher than the roof itself. The roof's backside was hanging in the woods. Magnolias. A thick green wall from the loading platform all the way out to Route 95 eastbound in Knoxville. Puffing on a cigarillo, Thomas Berryman took in every detail. As he was about to leave, Berryman saw a long-haired boy he'd noticed two or three times earlier that day. The boy was tall and skinny, wearing green army fatigues and smoked brown glasses. His hair was curly, and he made Berryman think of Oliver Twist. He'd been sitting at a bus stop. He'd been trying to make time with a little black waitress in Lums. Now he was sad-sacked on the white stone sidewalk in front of the market itself. He was watching the two black carpenters. Berryman made a mental note of the boy, then called it a day. On a per diem basis, he had made over $20,000. Nashville, June 27. By the selected day, Ben Toya told me, Berryman will have one plan he thinks is 100% foolproof. And if he doesn't think his plan is 100%, he'll walk away from the job. He did that with Jesse Jackson in Chicago. He likes challenges, but his challenges are in the figuring. Sitting in my workroom, thinking about Ben Toy again, one thing struck me that should have been clear to me before. Toy had hated Thomas Berryman. I wasn't so sure that he knew he did, but I was sure that he hated him. On the 27th day of June, Berryman shut himself in his hotel room, room 4H, from 6 to 6. He studied Jimmy Horn's known daily routines like a Talmudist. Berryman's hotel was a double-building rooming house in the hospital district west of West End Avenue in Nashville. It was called the Claremont and had a big sign on the porch, Home-Cooked Meals for Ladies and Gentlemen. Every afternoon at the Claremont, the regular boarders could be viewed in the lobby, eating mint ice and Nabiscos, watching the soaps or a baseball game. A room there cost Berryman $26.50 for the week. For his efforts that first morning, Berryman learned that Jimmy Horn was careless, but that his aides were not. That night, he actually followed Horn's car from City Hall. The mayor rode with an armed chauffeur and lots of company that evening, a cadre of paranoid white men who were constantly glancing around each new landscape, checking it for danger signs like scared jackrabbits. Another car, probably police, a green Dodge, also followed the Horn vehicle. Horn's little girl met the car at the head of the driveway, and he got out and walked with her to the main house. Their arm-in-arm walk was easily 500 yards, and Berryman wondered if they did it every night. The car went on ahead. The Dodge parked near the front gates. Looking on through roadside bramble and an 8-foot spiked fence, Berryman could hear their footsteps on gravel. He could also see another police patrol car parked in the circular part of the driveway up near the house. Jesus Christ, he was thinking. They sure watch out for his ass. Directly behind him, very close, Berryman heard bushes crashing down. He turned around to face a tall state trooper with a mustache. "You can't park here," the man stated in a matter-of-fact drawl. "You want your look at fancy niggers, you got to go to the movies. Move on now, buddy." "Do that," Berryman grinned as stupidly as he could. He got up from his knees and fled to his car in a fast duck waddle. "Yes, sir, do that right now," he stammered. "Damn idle curiosity, anyhow." Once back inside his car, driving down the asphalt road away from the mayor's mansion, Berryman could feel blood pounding in his brain. "Now, Thomas," he was thinking, "you've got to do a whole lot better than that," which he did.